I'm recording. Okay. Awesome. And it's making spikes when I talk. So.
Perfect.
That's preferable. That means it's working.
Yes.
Welcome to In Media Les. I'm Chloe.
And I'm Val.
And today it is my great pleasure to say that we have a guest on the show. It is Seth Dickinson, author of The Traitor Baru Cormorant, as well as the sequels to that book. Thank you so much for joining us, Seth.
Thank you for having me.
We were just hoping, well, I don't know what we were hoping for, but we are glad you're here. And we were hoping you could talk to us about, like...
We got questions. So, we got questions. Burning questions.
You have answers. Or perhaps more questions.
All right. Well, I assure you I've done zero prep. So whatever questions you have for me, you're going to get the raw, unfiltered, original draft.
Perfect. That's what we want to hear. Yeah.
That's exactly what we're here for. Okay, we did prepare for this.
Yes. Val, show us that preparation. Putting you on the spot.
Putting me on the spot? Is this question time?
Yes.
Okay. Let's do a question.
That's what we're here for.
Uh-huh. I don't usually listen to podcasts, but when I do,
fair.
I often find this super boring. And the reason is that the people don't have a conversation and kind of talk past each other. So I want to know, what do you guys do? What's your deal? Why do you have a podcast? Why did you invite me?
Okay. I see you don't want to answer our questions. Okay. So
it's a reverse Uno reverse card. We're answering his questions.
That's right.
We play D&D together and we're friendos. So we're like, why don't we also schedule an hour and a half of our time every week to just talk about gay stuff? And then we record it and we'll push it on to other people.
Pushers. I like it.
And we bicker constantly, so people find that very entertaining. So we thought maybe we could just put that bickering out into the world.
Excellent. Yeah. That's what I like.
I'm glad. And she hasn't killed my character yet. She's trying really hard, but...
Yeah, I'm the dungeon master, so...
All right, so Chloe, you're the dungeon master. Val, you're the hapless victim.
I'm the terror.
The willing victim. The victim who blunders into every possible worst situation.
When I was a teenager, I ran a game of D20 Modern, which is a really bad system. It was basically 3rd edition D&D, but in the current day. And my brother, he was a character in the game, and he rolled this character with amazing, like, technical skills, but his charisma was so low, we all agreed that he had, like, horrific mutilation. Because I was a teenager, I wasn't really politically aware. So I thought it was cool to just be like, nobody likes you because you're so ugly and fucked up. And we called this character Hamburger Face, and we made him sit in the van and never come with us on missions. But he turned out to be this incredible, like, tactical operator, because he'd be on the radios telling us what to do and, like, hacking the blueprints and shit. Then one time we were in a hostage situation, and he had to pretend to be the hostage takers so the SWAT team wouldn't realize they were actually... working for an AI or something, because you know these things happen in role-playing games. And he just completely flubbed his bluff, and he told the SWAT team that his demands were $1,500 and Chechen independence. I've been laughing about that ever since. My guy, he wants a small checking account in Chechnya. Anyway, that's my RPG
story.
That's
so weird. That happened in our game, too.
Yeah, and it's set in a fantasy Greek world, so demanding Chechen independence was
I always wondered why you put non-sequitur. That country in there.
Chechnya? Alright, hit me with your first question. Fuck me up.
Sure thing. I was always very curious if Baru was always going to be an accountant, or if there was another sort of menial... but a very important job that you had her doing beforehand.
I'm actually going to check for you. I'm pretty sure she was always going to be an accountant, but let's visit, you can hear my keyboard, the original short story, The Traitor Baru Cormorant, Her Failed General and Their Wounds, published in Beneath Ceaseless Skies, December 29th, 2011. Control F, accountant. She was indeed an accountant. She's an accountant by, like, paragraph 10 of that story. So, yes, she was always going to be an accountant.
And how did you decide on accountant?
That's a great question. As you may know, due to the linear and progressing nature of time, I wrote this story more than 10 years ago. And it's 10, 12 in the morning, and I haven't had my coffee. But as I recall, I really, really wanted to do a story about fiscal manipulation and that kind of stuff. I think because the world economy had collapsed when I was in college and, like, really fucked up my whole generation. Our whole generation, probably. Are you guys Zoomers or millennials?
Yep.
I'm on the cusp.
I'm a millennial. Val is like a younger cusp.
A moomer.
Of millennial and Zoomer.
I'm closer to 30 than 20.
Okay. Much but you closer. Know that's a great way to lie, right? I'm closer to 30 than 20 could mean you're 34.
Yes.
It's still technically correct.
Which is how old
Chloe's I am. Chloe's also closer to 30 than 20.
Yes. What was I talking about? Financial stuff. Yeah, financial manipulation. I thought it would be really interesting. There were a lot of influences that I think a little bit of The Cambist and Lord Iron by the guy who's one half of James S.A. Corey, Daniel Abraham. He's gone on to write several fantasy series I have not read, but he was kind of interested in money. He did this short story, The Cambist and Lord Iron, which was about money. I thought it was cool. I don't remember anything about it. But yeah, mostly the world economy had collapsed, and I really was like, why did this happen? How did this happen? How did everything get so fucked up without anything real occurring? It was like sorcery to me. You know, everyone had suddenly gotten much poorer because of the collapse of the value of these unreal bundles of promises. And, like, wealth had been built on the idea that these promises were reliable, and they turned out to be unreliable. And this connection between money and treason and the reliability of promises and credit, I think, drew me in. But I was a much stupider person at the time. I'm still really stupid, but at the time, I was differently stupid. And so I think writing this short story, my primary motivation was, boy, it would be cool to get a short story published. And the accountant stuff just followed naturally from my interests. That was a really rambling answer.
No, it was pretty great.
That was a great answer.
I think that's how Chloe got me to read the book. She was, like, telling me a little bit about what it's about. And then in the end of her pitch, she very quietly said, and she's also an accountant. And I think that's when she got me to read it.
It's just so interesting because usually in a lot of fantasy series, the protagonist is always like, I don't know, they're really skilled at magic or the chosen one or at least they're drawn into these circumstances through some other means. It's just so interesting to have a book where it's just like,
accountant. It's underused, the power of money. Money scandals are really intuitive. There's drama that you have to set up in a story. Like if I try to explain that Volbird Hangelson has suffered the ancestral curse of his house, I have to explain to the reader why they should give a shit about Volbird Hangelson and the ancestral curse, which is that his toenails are filled with tiny holes that grow pomegranate seeds. All of this requires a lot of, like, why should I give a shit? But if you say somebody is 35,000 gold coins in debt to the Central Bank of Fuckaloo, everyone's like, oh, that's bad. The Central Bank has some power over this dude. They can make him do stuff. It's the same as sex scandals. Like, everybody instantly understands it's bad if you're fucking your babysitter, your child's babysitter or whatever.
Both of those situations are pretty bad.
They are. But only one of them has happened to Arnold Schwarzenegger, as far as I know. Not the 35,000 gold coins in debt to anyone. Although Conan the Barbarian is a great movie. I wanted to say that the accountant thing also works in the story because the original premise for the story was a entry on the Evil Overlord list, which is this ancient internet artifact, which is called the Top 100 Things I'll Do If I Become an Evil Overlord. And it's all really simple, like jokes we would make back in the 90s about media when I was like 7 or whatever. You know, my legions of terror will have clear plexiglass helmets, not face-concealing ones that make it hard to aim. And if I have the hero at gunpoint and he says, wait, there's something I have to tell you before you kill me, I will say no and then shoot him. Or I'll shoot him and then say no. It's just all stuff like that. But the second thing that came to me was that the character, Baru, would have hemi neglect, and that this would be a physical incarnation of her divided loyalties. And there's a big political issue with using disability as allegory, but in this case, I don't think... To me, hemi neglect, at least at the time, in 2011, 11 years ago, one, I wasn't as politically conscious. Two, I didn't think enough people struggled with hemi neglect as an accessibility issue that they would get mad at me for using it as an allegory. That's a really bad answer. Again, I'm sorry, I haven't had my coffee. My point is, the hemi neglect, which is, you know, you can only conceptualize half of the world around you. The canonical example is if you're asked to draw a clock, you draw all the digits 1 through 12 on just half of the clock face. This idea of only being able to perceive half the page, like half the account, to me worked really well with somebody who worked with books, because, you know, books have two pages in front of you, or maybe a ledger has two columns, and the idea of only being able to recognize one at a time, to me, was, like, really powerful. So, accountant goes with the brain damage.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Do you want to get your coffee, speaking of?
Yes, thank you. I'll be right back.
Man, I wish I drank coffee, because then I could have that, like, I'm getting my coffee.
This is what tea is for.
Yeah, but, like, the coffee takes, what, 5 minutes? The tea, you have to wait for the water to boil, and then you have to make it. And it's a very...
I feel like coffee and tea making are very similar processes as well.
No, there's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, tea is easier. you put the thing in, you steep it for 3 minutes, then you take it out. Coffee, you have to grind the beans, you have to...
You have a little machine in the kitchen that does it for you.
Yeah, but you still have to do it. Okay.
It is true that I am incredibly lazy about making coffee. I used to prep cold brew the night before, but I just got so sick of grinding. Which takes like 4 minutes at most. You turn the little handle and it grinds the beans. It was so much work when I could spend those 4 minutes sitting on my ass refreshing the same 5 websites that
Look,
I stopped
doing.
If you spend
those 4 minutes grinding the beans, you could miss someone making a new post.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it could be a bad post, and you need to own them. So, like, gotta own your posting enemies, right?
Exactly. Death to those who post incorrectly. I was going to say, that was me snapping my fingers. I don't know if that even catches on a mic. I was going to say something stupid about podcasts or books. Oh, yeah. I was going to plug Wolf Hall. Wolf Hall is a novel by Hilary Mantel. It's a fantasy novel, despite being set in history and using only historical characters and being completely realistic. The reason it's fantasy is because it's about a fucking king and political drama, and fantasy is whatever we say it is, and I say that's fantasy. People love Game of Thrones, and Game of Thrones is dumb. And if Game of Thrones can be fantasy, so is Wolf Hall. People are mad at the author, Man Booker Prize winner Hilary Mantel, because she said some dumb shit or something on Twitter, but I don't have Twitter, so I can pretend not to know about that, and recommend this book. It's about Thomas Cromwell, who's, according to Hilary Mantel, basically the coolest guy ever, and is the advisor to King Henry VIII, the one who had 6 wives. And Henry really, really wants to divorce his first wife and marry his second wife. Well, she's not the second wife yet. But the Catholic Church is like, no, you cannot divorce. It is a holy sacrament. So Henry is turning to his advisors to be like, how do I get out of this marriage? And Thomas Cromwell's patron, the Cardinal of something, fails and basically gets destroyed. He gets exiled from court and dies alone. And the king turns to Cromwell and is like, Cromwell, get me out of this marriage. And Cromwell has to figure out how to get him out of the marriage while also keeping the kingdom together through things like monetary policy, religious reform, taking all the monasteries from the monks and turning them into the king's property. He's a huge bastard. But it's a really, really interesting book and very, very well written. In a strange, hard-to-describe way. Also, spoilers, because it's history, Crummel dies in the end, which is kind of interesting, because he's such a scheming bastard who's hyper-competent at everything. But in the end, he does fuck up, and the king has him executed. That's not for three books, but great series. I really liked it.
That sounds pretty fun. Also kind of like an accountant, but like a jack of all trades.
He's very much... So one of Cromwell's problems is he has to deal with the English aristocracy. No, nobility. Which one of those indicates... Royalty indicates they're related to the king. Nobility is just like general nobles, and aristocracy is a synonym with nobility?
I think so. That sounds right. I don't know what words mean.
Even if they mean different things, it's usually the same people.
I do numbers.
I actually do words, but I also don't know what words mean.
So Cromwell, I think it's the Duke of North something. These dukes are constantly like, hey, Cromwell, you're an asshole. Let's fuck shit up my way. And Cromwell's like, no, you got to listen to me. So in the scene where he's trying to explain to one of the aristocrats why he does things the way he does, Cromwell just has this incredible internal monologue, which goes, and I quote, "How can he, Cromwell, explain that to him, the Duke? The world is not run from where the Duke thinks, not from border fortresses, not even from Whitehall. The world is run from Antwerp, from Florence, from places the Duke has never imagined, from Lisbon, from where the ships with sails of silk drift west and are burned up in the sun, not from the castle walls, but from the counting houses, not by the call of the bugle, but by the click of the abacus, not by the grate and click of the mechanism of the gun, but by the scrape of the pen on the page of the promissory note that pays for the gun and the gunsmith and the powder and the shot." That's really cool. That's Wolf Hall. That's also kind of what Baru is about, except Baru is also about colonialism.
Yeah. Speaking of, what was the process you kind of went through? Were there sensitivity readers or things like that when it came to writing this sort of depiction of colonial... I always mess up this word.
Colonialism?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I had a lot of first readers on that book. But I would not say any of them were specific. I had readers who were, I don't want to say colonized subjects. That sounds so fucked up. But they were from post-colonial backgrounds or had academic backgrounds in colonialism or, best of all, both. A big inspiration. Inspiration is wrong. I tried not to be inspired by any one thing because I think it is illegal intellectually to lift things directly from history and move them into a secondary world, because everything that happens in the world is overdetermined. There are like 9 million pathways of causality that cause a thing to happen the way it does in a specific place at a specific time to specific people. You can't lift up the event and move it into your fantasy setting and then ignore all those causal pathways that caused it and just pretend it could have happened the same way in another world. So my rule of thumb for writing colonialism stuff in Baru is that I can replicate the logic of colonialism. And by logic, I don't mean that in an approving way. I'm not like colonialism is very logical and good. Just the processes of colonialism, but not the events exactly. It's my job to look at how colonialism worked in the real world, try to take some general principles from it, move those principles over to a new world, look at the specific material and intellectual conditions of this new world, mix those up with the colonial process, and come up with new events. But that said, yeah, I had a very smart friend she's from an Indian background. India was obviously colonized. She recommended some great books that I picked details from. There are a couple chapters in Baru the First that are just going through what life is like in this sort of syncretic is too healthy a word. This messed up colonial society. And there are details there that were lifted from the British Raj in India because they made sense in Baru's setting of encrasticism and Falcrest occupying Ardwin. Stuff like hiring nannies to read English scripture to your children so that they wouldn't be like polluted by the ambient Indian language. That's stuff that happened in real history. So I would say my focus was less on not, I don't want to use the word offending, A book is like a COVID virus. It's got all these different spikes coming out that can bind to different receptor sites on readers. But readers are pretty various, too. Like, spikes that really hit the receptors on one reader will just poke and annoy a different reader. So it is possible to write something that is truthful, but still really offensive to one reader, and that makes another reader feel really seen. Like, oh, this is exactly what happened to my ancestors or to me. And that's not a good or bad thing. That's just the nature of heterodox human experience. I've wandered from your question, but yes, there was research. There was not as much research as I could have done because I had finite time and finite money. And are there things I wish I could have researched more? Yeah, absolutely. There are things I would do 11 years later differently. But if I hadn't learned anything in the past 11 years, I would be more of a failure than I am. So it's good that there are things I would want to do differently now.
That's really interesting. So, okay, so sorry, you mentioned a lot about causality and, well, I am kind of like a causal inferentist by training, actually, because I'm an epidemiologist, so we do a lot of causal inference.
Man, you're having a moment.
Yeah.
Terrible moment.
Yeah, this has been, you know, like, it was always a joke that everyone thought epidemiologists were like dermatologists. Now, I don't get to make that joke anymore, but people have found out about my profession in the worst possible way.
But I mean, you guys called all this. It has been known for years that a coronavirus from Asia will spread across the world and cause a global pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, we had SARS. We got so lucky with SARS back in, like, what was it, like 2002? And this was only a matter of time.
Yeah, Steven Soderbergh made a great movie about it.
I have not seen that. I try not to watch movies because they make me anxious about diseases. I don't know.
It would probably make you anxious, but it's a bat coronavirus gets picked up by some business travelers in China. It spreads to the U.S. There's a fake cure that becomes really popular and pushed by online alternative medicine proponents. Just like everything is.
Oh, gosh. It's... Oh, okay.
There's a couple waves of variants, you know. Mm-hmm. Everything was predicted. Yeah, I'm not a crazy conspiracy theorist. I'm saying scientists did a really good job.
Yeah. No, it could be both. But, like, no, it's true. Like, all this stuff probably could have been predicted. I mean, was predicted. We knew about this sort of thing coming. But anyways, I wanted to get to my question. So you know, you've talked about your interest in, like, monetary policy. As you know, one thing that comes through to me in your books is this kind of interest in these long causal chains or cycles, or, you know, like the way things lead back, as you said, through, like, the promissory notes, or, you know, how the financial resources dictate reality. So these, and I know you have a background in neuroscience as well, which is also very interested in how things are caused by external stimuli and whatnot. So I was wondering, when you, like, write the book, do you sit there and think about, like, okay, here's all the causal chains. Do you, like, write them down, or do they just kind of emerge naturally?
More emerge naturally. So I am slightly infamous back when I had a Reddit account for my broadsides against world building and against the kind of scrupulous mimesis of a fictional world that leads to fantasy novels having appendices explaining their magic system, or maps. I have maps in my book, but for a specific reason, which is character building. They are maps tied to a specific character and the way she looks at the world, and that's really important because, oh, I'm going to drop a big name now. Have you read Seeing Like a State?
No, I don't read any books.
Nice. I like that. That is a stance. Seeing Like a State is a book about why high modernity failed. And by high modernity, it specifically means the attempt to go out into the world, do a census, for example, of where people live and how they grow crops, derive some rules. For example, you look at your census and you say, well, the people who grow beans in fields fertilized with guano have the best yields. From now on, everyone will grow beans in fields fertilized by guano, and that will maximize our crop yields. And as you can imagine, this leads to everybody growing the same bean in conditions that are not suited to that bean, and fields that aren't suited to that fertilizer, and then there's a crop blight, and all the beans die, and everybody starves. And what Seeing Like a State is about is about how there's this incredibly detailed, I'm going to call it folk wisdom, which is the knowledge that you derive from living in a place for a really long time and getting really good at living there. And high modern projects that attempt to rationalize how people live often ignore this wisdom and scrub it away. And to me, top-down world building that attempts to, as you say, map out all the causal chains of how everything works is itself an attempt to render the whole world legible, to make a census of it, to be able to answer to your reader, this is how this works. In the land of Kuzbania, they use purple dye and the official royal pens because 200 years ago, the conquerors of Kuzbania brought the big snail cow that produces purple dye from its teats, and it became a sign of the royal house. That kind of shit is poison to me. What you should be doing, you should be figuring out not the end product, not the final causal map of how your settings work, but the rules of both the setting and the narrative in the setting that govern how these causal chains happen. Not mapping every link in the chain, but giving the reader an idea of how each link is shaped and where it comes from and who forges it with what intent, and teaching the reader how to imagine the world in the same way that you're imagining it, so when they look at the edge of the map and wonder what's over there, they can think about it in the same way that you are, and the story goes on living in their heads, and the characters go on living in their head, and there's this deep connection between the logic of the setting and the characters and the choices they make in the plot. For example, in the first Baru novel, the governing principle of everything is that Baru is able to get past any obstacle in the book by throwing something away, by making a sacrifice of something she cares about or some part of herself. And the book ends, and I strongly think this is where books should end, or at least where the climax should happen, when that logic breaks down, when she can no longer go on operating as she has. And that logic is reflected in the world. There's constantly this question everyone is asking of how much are we willing to give up in order to get by? Are we willing to give up our culture in order to have better sewers? And in a lot of ways, by the way, Falkrest as a colonizer is much, much nicer than in real life. In real life, they wouldn't give you better sewers in exchange for oppressing you. They would just oppress you and kill you a ton and not do anything for you. That's how real life colonialism works. So I don't want to sound like a colonialism apologist. But again, for the purpose of this book, for the purpose of this rhetorical construct, it was great to have that core logic of, like, what are you willing to give up? And that, to me, is how the causal chains work. Short answer to your question. No, I do not map out the causal chains. I always seek to have a set of principles in my mind that dictate how the chains play out without actually mapping out the chains. And here's the trick. Here's the trick. The human mind loves patterns. If I say A, B, C, D, your brain will fill in E. But if I say A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, your brain gets bored and is like, okay, it's the alphabet. So you can't give people consistent patterns. People don't actually like consistent, well-thought-out things. If you look at big nerd discussions on forums about fictional universes, the stuff they talk about all the time is the inconsistencies. If I say A, B, C, D, baboon, F, G, H, J, K, shark, you're going to remember the baboon and the shark, because those are the breaks from the pattern. That's what interests your brain. So there should always, in my opinion, be inconsistency in your world building to reflect the fact that the real world is not totally understandable and can't be fully understood by any one person, because humans, as a whole, are cultural learners, and we evolved to receive skills packages that were developed by our ancestors over tens or hundreds of generations that we obey and use without needing to fully understand why they work. That's what we as organisms are evolved to do. There should always be more going on than you're aware of and can understand, or it doesn't feel real. Finish.
Was there any trait of this world building that did kind of pull you into that direction more than others? Because I know that I've read a handful of very well-written and pretty big sci-fi and fantasy books, and I can almost always point out like a paragraph or two where I can see that someone told the author, like, I don't get it. Can you explain this? And the author kind of like had to explain a thing. Was there anything like that that taunted you at any point?
I believe that what people ultimately care about in books is characters. Because people, again, we've evolved and learned to think about other people. So we should learn about the world the same way the characters learn about the world. And this has occasionally been difficult because people are really fond of the gotcha quote, where they grab a screen grab from their Kindle reader and post it on Twitter and say, yikes! And it's like some character saying, like, everybody with a web between their forefinger and their thumb should be put in a cask of liquor and pickled. And they're always like, yikes, this guy hates people with web thumbs. I just made that up. I don't know. Are there people with web thumbs? I've got a little, you know, bit of skin there. Anyway, it's hard to have your characters express their beliefs about the world because you're trusting the reader to know that you're not telling them objective truth. You're not saying, okay, great example. In the Baru books, Falkris believes that women are better at mathematics and abstract reasoning, and therefore make good navigators. I have had readers believe that the Baru novels are set in an alternate universe where women are better at math. That is almost a direct quote. It seemed more probable to them that brains just work differently here and were highly gendered than that there were different cultural beliefs that shaped how societies thought about people's talents.
That's fascinating.
I understand that because humans are cognitive misers, and especially when you're in reader's trance, you're not stopping and thinking critically about every sentence. But it's still funny to me. Did that remotely answer the question?
We can say yes.
Well, give me the question.
I understood the logic of the answer, at least.
Yes, we formed that pattern.
You're asking like how I handle info dumping and telling
if anything things? At any point tripped you up on that, because I'm a very, very big fan of world building as you explained it. It's one of my favorite things.
To totally defy everything I just said, I will sometimes just have characters magically intuit causal pathways. Like, she could tell that particular formation of phalanx fighters died in a particular way because they came from an area with insufficiently good cows to make good leather for their shields because the cows couldn't get enough feed because of tax policy. I will sometimes just have a character just expound on how things work, but hopefully in a way that makes sense for that character to know. I think a lot of times folk wisdom, as I've called it, the sort of expertise of living, which is the stuff writers can't make up. There's absolutely no way you can imagine yourself living in the Amazon basin and imagine all the little tricks of, like, how to get that tasty honey out of that beehive or how to select certain kinds of plants to eat. You can't imagine that as a writer. The only thing you could do is find somebody from the Amazon basin and be like, hey, how did you live in that particular area you were from? I think that folk wisdom is often a tractable mental abstraction of the really complicated causal maps that I will occasionally put on the page. You know what I mean? Like, you can have an analyst who's like, the Mongols used this form of horn shortbow because it delivered an extra 25 newtons of force when fired from horseback. But then a Mongol warrior would probably be like, this bow is awesome, and it's way better. That's why we use it. That's the same knowledge, but in different modes of knowing.
Have you ever read The Book of Why by Udaya Pearl?
I have not. The Book of Five?
Book of Why. He's a very famous, he's a computer scientist who became a causal inference guy, literally wrote the book on causal inference. And I'm just thinking about, he wrote this like mass market version of his extremely technical computer science based textbook called The Book of Why. And he talks a lot about how we conceive about causality from a scientific perspective and how that relates to like how just generally humans think about causality, like naturally. And that's what I'm thinking about as you're talking about this. Yeah. Don't ever check out his Twitter though. He's got some really heinous political views, but it's a good book. Just don't look at his politics.
The Book of Why Are You Like This?
Yes.
Talking about causality and how we think about causality, One exercise I really like is in attempting to define what a character is. Like you're teaching giving a lecture on characters or something. I love this psych experiment where they had just abstract geometric shapes move around on a screen. So like, say there's a big square, a red triangle, and three little dots. And the three little dots move around the perimeter of the square and then go inside it, while the red triangle goes from bottom left to top right. When people watch this, they will say, the big angry triangle chased the three little dots and they hid inside the square. They'll attribute motive and internal states to these really, really basic geometric primitives. Primitives is like a technical term. I'm not calling them... I'm not being a fucking racist about triangles. And that to me is also a really cool lesson. We make characters out of everything. That's why everything has to be rooted in character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. We give all of our rovers names and wonder what they feel like on Mars.
Talk about how lonely they are.
Celebrate their birthdays.
Okay, I've got a question. So I have made no secret, I'm a big fan of your books, and I've given them out as gifts, and one of the friends that I forced to read, Traitor, I was talking to her on Discord last night, and I said, like, you know, I'm interviewing the author tomorrow, do you have any questions? And she screamed this at me, so this is coming from my friend Sarah. She yelled this question at me, and the question is, I'm trying to think of how to put this in the kind of demeanor that she put in, that which was not accusatory, it was like happy. Why is Baru such a good lesbian?
I mean, lesbians do really like Baru and Tainhu and the people Baru meets. You know, there are people who think she doesn't read as an authentic lesbian and people who think she does really read as an authentic lesbian. And again, that's because people have heterodox experiences, or homodox in this case. There's so much pressure on every single character who's not like a white dude named Brandon Slamthrust to represent everyone of their particular intersection. And by intersection, I mean whatever converging vectors of oppression are focused on that character. There's just so much pressure for everyone to be something to everyone. And I think the reason Baru works for so many people is that she's not attempting to be something for everyone. She's very specifically herself. She has very specific problems that are protagonist problems, which are not necessarily created by her being a colonized person or being a lesbian, but intersect with those identities in ways unique to her. So the fact that she's very calculating and really tries to maximize her own agency until she gets really depressed and can't do it anymore is a trait of her as a person. It's not something that everyone's like, oh yes, all lesbians are calculating Machiavellian manipulators. No, that's just Baru. Well, it's others too, but it's mostly, it's a trait of Baru, not a trait that's meant to be generalized to everyone like her. But the fact that she is that way influences how she expresses or doesn't express her sexuality. And I think the reason people like her is there is no part of her that can be taken in isolation from any other part of her. And the parts of her that go out into the rest of the story, like the outcomes of her choices, cannot be taken in isolation from who she is. For example, spoiler warning, big spoilers, I'm about to spoil the end of the first Baru Cormorant book. If you don't want to get the end spoiled, close the tab, close the program. At the end of the first book, she makes a decision to honor Tainhu's wishes to die as an honorable warrior rather than live as a hostage. And that decision could be the same if she were a straight woman and Tainhu were some noble duke. Could make the exact same decision. It could still be a wrenching tragedy. But the fact that they're both women, also taps into, both in their world and in real life, this narrative of lesbian tragedy and of how it's got to end with one of them dying or miserable. And the fact that it's that vehicle specifically Tane Hu chooses for her subversion, basically saying, we're going to act out this lesbian tragedy so that you can get the power you need to take down this empire, to change the story from within, is part of what makes it powerful. Does that make any sense? It wouldn't be quite the same if she were executing a dude, because there wouldn't be that story to tap into of how the hegemonic society wants the lesbians to get done, you know?
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't have spent, like, 400 pages watching her keep this secret and be afraid to act on it. I know the episode is not out yet, so there's no way you could have heard it, but when we talk about the book, unless you did and you're really, really good at hacking, that's one of the things that we talked about. The fact that the ending didn't feel like a lot of the other times that there were unhappy endings.
It wasn't a bury the gaze, even though it, you know, was one of the it was Tane Hu dying, but it didn't feel like bury the gaze.
Yeah, that's something I spent a couple of years struggling with. Very, like, very literally a couple of years where the first and last thing I would think about every day was, my God, what have I done with this book? I was really depressed, and so it was just, like, the thing I would fixate on. And one thing that got me through that was thinking about how many stories you could not put queer characters into without it being some kind of queer tragedy, and therefore untellable. Like Star Wars. Are you going to make, you know, there are so many characters in Star Wars you couldn't turn gay without it suddenly being a bury your gays tragedy. And that sucks to me. We shouldn't, we should be allowed to turn characters in Star Wars gay, you know? Or Shakespeare, you know, you can't put queer characters into most of Shakespeare's tragedies without it suddenly becoming bury your gays. And what that said to me was, there's a difference between a tragic story with queer characters in it and a story that is specifically meant to say queer people can't be happy. Now, of course, the Barrow Cormorant books do deal specifically with oppression of queer people. And so you could argue that there's a moral obligation to show the characters triumphing and getting through that and being together happily in the end. But to me, it is false and condescending to say that every single lesbian in my story is going to be happy in their first relationship, and it's going to be a happily ever after, and nothing bad is going to happen to them. Because there's more to life than, you know, shitty things do happen to us, and we have to figure out how to live through them. There have to be stories about being in that terrible place and coming back from it, rather than just stories about never going to the terrible place in the first place. If that makes any sense at all.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also the fact that throughout the book, Baru does make a lot of decisions that lead to this outcome.
Yes.
And like, out of all the possible decisions she could make, this seems to be the one to get her to her goal, no matter how painful it is. So, like, I think the fact that it was part of the plan in some sense, and it is furthering her agenda, and the fact that Tane Hu also not only agreed, but in the end decided to go out in a way where she had some power left, I think all of those things in congruity made it okay. Okay, so after finishing the book and yelling at Chloe,
yep,
I did read the first like 5 pages of the second book, and then I realized I was exhausted, but it was a different type of exhaustion from consuming this book than, say, a movie I watched. I'm not going to name the movie, but it's a movie that I watched that was queer, and it was like the first one I've ever seen, and it ended horribly. Like, people died. It was
How dare you not? What, you gotta name it. You can't say stuff like that and not name it.
Oh, absolutely not. Gotta keep you guessing.
Oh, come on. Rude.
And, like, that movie still stuck with me. But every time I think about it, I get really angry. With this book, what happened was I kept seeing Baru's story and the choices she made throughout the whole book in, like, hindsight, and could see that this was the only outcome. Because they could have become happy in the end, quote-unquote, if she decided to become a complete pawn, right? If she just said, no, save her. I will. You can keep her as a hostage, and I'll still have her by my side. And she didn't, and it's like, it makes sense after everything that she's been through. And all the times that you told us that, like, there is a thing coming and she doesn't want to acknowledge it and something strange is happening, so keep an eye out. But we as readers, because of that pattern recognition that you talked about, I personally didn't want to think about what she was going to do.
No,
and I didn't.
Yeah. Neither does she.
Yeah.
And I do think, in thinking about the ending, a lot of people neglect Tenhu's agency there, in that Baru did save her. Baru exiled her and sent her to safety. And, you know, minor spoiler, but the second book does dig into the fact that she chose to come back and be captured. You know, she could have fled into the mountains and lived there, but she didn't want to. And part of that is that she knew her oath to Baru went two ways, and that if she was faithful to her oath, Baru would be faithful to her oath to Tenhu, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Like, what's a good way to put it? You know, Tenhu is she's a feudal warrior. She's a knight. She's driven by a sense of honor. And I think if she had been taken captive and the Masquerade had said to Baru, spare her life and we'll let you be our agent, Baru would have done it. She would have said, yes, spare her. Don't kill her. And Baru would have become a pawn. It was Tenhu's strength, not Baru's, mm-hmm. that led to the ending of that book. It was Tenhu who said, you gotta kill me. And a lot of people see the ending of that book as her... Well, a lot of people. Some people read the ending of that book as Tenhu being brutally executed, which it is. But it's also Tenhu choosing to die by ordeal, the way her honor dictates, you know, the way a lot of feudal warriors would prefer to go out, keeping their oath and proving their physical valor, rather than being kept as some sort of craven political instrument. Yeah. To me, that was the choice. That was how Tenhu would have wanted to go. And it was important to me that, because so much of the book is about how people express agency, even when they're theoretically under the control of others, it was important to me to let her have that. There's a novel I really love. It's a young adult novel called Codename Verity. And it's about a woman who, she flies planes for the British during World War II. She's part of the, like, Women's Auxiliary Air Force, I think. And one of the jobs she has is delivering people to agents to occupied France. And she gets shot down or crashes and is captured by the Germans. And the whole book is her writing things while in captivity by the Gestapo. And you start to realize not everything she's writing is exactly true. She's putting messages and stuff in the text for someone, and you start to, like, get on her wavelength. Like, she's not just telling a story. She's in captivity and is trying to get a message out. And that was a book I read after writing the first Baru novel, but to me it's a similar thing, and they have similar endings. I recommend it. It's a heartbreaker, but in a good way. Again, I think there's a difference between the good pain of, like, having worked out really hard, not that I've ever done that, but, you know, of having exerted yourself and broken things that are going to fix, and the bad pain of, like, having an infected fingernail or something where you poke it and you're like, oh, that's wrong. To me, there are different kinds of tragic or sad endings, and some of them are the good pain and some are the bad pain. I also just want to say real quick, sorry, yeah. I'm cutting you off.
Oh, go ahead.
Just about twists. I don't think that twists work the way people think they do, where something comes out of nowhere and blindsides you. For example, Game of Thrones, the books, A Song of Ice and Fire. I think all the famous things people say are twists, like Ned dying and the Red Wedding, are not twists at all. They're telegraphed hundreds of pages in advance. Characters are like, hey, if you don't change your behavior, something really bad is going to happen. The reason we think of them as twists is because we expect the author to swerve, to point the car at a mine and drive straight at the mine and say, oh, we're driving at a mine. Pretty tense, huh? And then at the last minute, the car will swerve and save the character. And in these cases, the car just drives onto the mine and blows up. And the reason it's satisfying is because it was set up so far in advance. Mm-hmm. Not because it came out of nowhere.
Oh, man, now
I think you do that well.
I'm thinking about Knights of the Old Republic. Have you ever played that?
Yeah.
One of the most famous twists in gaming, but, like, there's so much set up to it in retrospect.
I have a friend who's replaying it, and he named his character Totally Not Revan. So there's a scene where the character says, I'm not Revan anymore. I'm totally not Revan.
Sorry, spoilers we just for spoiled. Knights of the Old Republic, by the way.
Gets fucked, spoiler haters.
It's like a 20-year-old game at this point.
I'm surrounded by scientists and nerds. It's great.
Yeah. That's what you signed up for, Val.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with us, Seth. This was...
Wait, are we done?
Oh, yeah. We're at the hour mark. Yeah.
You don't understand. I have a book due tomorrow, and when you stop interviewing me, I have to go work on it.
We can keep going.
At this point, I think we're done with the questions, because that felt like a really, really good closer.
He can interview us.
But if you want to procrastinate, we are here for you.
Do you guys play any board games other than D&D?
Yeah, I play Gloomhaven. I have some copies of other stuff right on the shelf next to me. Clank. I don't know. What else do I got here? Love Letter.
I played Root. That was very fun.
Yeah, Root. That was designed by a goon, wasn't it?
I don't know what that means.
Val is not on something awful.
Bless you.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
It's a Reddit thing.
Yeah. No.
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 Oh, you insulted me.
Oh my God, that was so insulting, Val.
I'm so sorry. That usually works when people tell me something I don't know, and I'm like, "What is that?" The answer is 99% of the times it's a Reddit thing. This is the 1% that it wasn't.
Yeah, imagine the kind of people for whom Reddit is too populist and...
Yeah.
And,
okay.
I don't know.
That's where Seth and I frequent.
I see.
Okay.
So it's a subreddit.
I see.
Oh.
Are you guys Destiny players?
I have played both. I know you wrote The Taken King.
I didn't write the whole thing.
Okay.
I wrote a bit of web lore that became popular.
Okay.
Yeah.
My brother played it. I personally have no attention span.
what fits in your attention span, gaming-wise?
What were you up until 4:30 playing last night, Val?
I was playing RimWorld.
Oh yeah,
it's very fun, Chloe.
People can
I can't judge. I was up until 2 playing Elden Ring, so
it's very good.
They try to sell me on RimWorld with these stories like, oh yes, I created a vat of inbred cannibals, and by eating each other's strongest proteins, they became the lords of the wasteland, and now they all have cybernetic dildos on their heads or something. There are always these horrible, like, hostel-style stories about horrific things happening. I'm like, RimWorld.
I made a farm, and everyone is pretty happy in my colony.
Wow, that's way better RimWorld.
Yeah. Wait, you were telling me something about, like, cannibalism.
No, they have this, so whenever the pawns fight, we can see descriptions of what they do. and they're always some weird stuff like Kevin chewed off Ruthie's leg in a social fight. And it's like very, very violent.
It's a social fight.
It's when your colonists have either low moods or insult each other and get mad at each other, and they just like beat each other up until someone goes down.
So Kevin got angry at Ruth and bit off her leg.
Happens very often.
Wow.
So okay. It's a game with violent descriptions, but you make what you want of it. It's very fun.
I play a lot of Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri, which is like a civilization-style game set in space. And in that game, your discontented citizens, who are called drones, start rioting, you can do various things to make them happier, give them entertainment, better working conditions, or you can click the fucking nerve staple button. And I don't know what nerve stapling is, but it does exactly like what it sounds like. It suppresses those drone riots. It suppresses them good. And the problem is, there was one game where I nerve stapled so many of my colonists that they became immune to further nerve stapling. So their brains were like fully stapled, but they were still upset with my regime. It was pretty dark.
That's the whole story. Tells you a few things about humanity.
Yeah, it shows you that resistance can thrive, even under conditions of violent neurosurgery.
I think the last game I could pay attention to that had like a story was The Last of Us 2.
That was
a really good game.
I should play that sometime.
You should.
Yeah, Val is still on my case because we need to do an episode about it sooner or later.
I never mention it. I just quietly, adjacent to you, talk about the game to other people.
Meanwhile, I just yell at her to play Final Fantasy XIV.
Weird. I played Final Fantasy VII, so I have no attachment to that from childhood. But my partner did, and she was like, you got to play the Final Fantasy VII remake. It's shockingly good. And I was like, yeah, sure. But then I played it, and I was like, wow, this is shockingly good. Stupid, but in endearing ways rather than not endearing ways. And a lot of things I expected to find really annoying were actually quite well done. It has one of my favorite levels in video games because it captured the weird experience of it being like 2 a.m. and being really drunk with somebody you've just met recently, like wandering around some downtown area where everybody's fucking partying and being stupid. Not a lot of video games have explored that urban drunk experience.
It is. Well, okay, we are New Yorkers, so we're very familiar with it. But I don't know how other places kind of have that. I feel it
happens everywhere, Val.
I know it does, but I feel like there's more representation for places that are not New York and that. So I always appreciate something that tells me exactly how it feels to do exactly that on the streets of Manhattan.
I always suspect that's more of a non-American thing than an American thing, because so many American cities are poisoned by cars, not just like the physical cars driving around, but the need to zone for parking lots. Everything becomes really far apart and not walkable, whereas a city like Rome or I don't know, one of those cool Eastern European cities the kids are always talking about, like Prague or Tokyo, I imagine, not that Tokyo doesn't have cars, but I imagine that experience of like just being in a crowd of people all walking around, having a good time on a summer night is more accessible if your social spaces aren't separated by a mile of freeway.
Yeah.
I don't know. I went to school in the Midwest and like, I don't know. I remember a lot of college. Like it was a long walk, but we would just like drunkenly wander the streets of St. Paul.
I was at Chicago. So if you drunkenly wandered, you would freeze to death.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, St. Paul is not the warmest place either in the winter, but
true.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. I feel like I answered like three questions at a length of about 19 minutes each, but
they were wonderful perfect questions. What can
and,
I say?
And then the question I asked from Sarah, which you made gold out of a really bad question, so thank you for that.
Yeah. Why do people? I was talking to Tamsin about this, like, why are our lesbians so popular? And I really did want to, you should keep this in the edit, by the way. I really did want to thank the people who just like coerce their friends into reading these books, because The books would not have succeeded without that. You know, the first one was published in 2015, which I believe is now 7 years ago. The series did not earn out until last year. So the way earning out works is it means your books have made enough money to make up for the advance the publisher paid you, and you start getting royalties. And I really think the only reason they did earn out and have had kind of a surge in popularity recently is because of word of mouth, because of fan art in particular. I think fan art has really, really helped. Because of crossover from Tamsin Murr's Locked Tomb books, which are more popular and really awesome and deservingly so. Although Tamsin and I won't read each other's books because we're too insecure. So we both just like refuse to read each other's work because we think we'll feel shitty about ours. Which is it's a big writer thing. That's how writers are. Anyway, thank you to the fans for torturing your friends into buying the books. It's made a measurable difference in my life. My apartment is like falling apart and infested with German roaches. A year ago, if I sat down to write, the roaches would crawl on me. And now, a year later, they don't crawl on me anymore, which is partly because I have more money.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Thank you all for tuning in. We want to plug our social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest at InMediaLez. We have a subreddit r/InMediaLez. Our website is InMediaLez.com. You can email us at InMediaLez@gmail.com. If you email us a question or a comment, we'd be happy to read it on air sometime, if you are okay with that. And please like, subscribe, review this podcast. Thank you all so much for tuning in, and thank you, Seth, for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Anything you would like to plug before we go? Anything, any personal projects or social media?
When's the fourth book coming out?
That's a great question. So I finished most of a draft of it last year, and I'm not 100% happy with it. And then I started a new job, and I have been editing this book that's been sitting in editing hell for years and is now due tomorrow. Once I'm done with that, I'll get back to Baru 4. I really want it to be good, you know? I want it to be good more than I want it to come out soon. But it's
fair.
It's not the kind of when is the last book coming out that affects some other series where the writer just isn't working on it. I have been doing lots and lots of writing. I want to get it right, you know? There's a lot of... I have a killer outline. It's fantastic. I just want to... I want to execute it just right.
It's okay. I'm a very slow reader, so by the time I finish the second and the third in 7 to 8 years, it should be out.
Yeah. So I wrote the second and the third as basically one book, but Tor decided to split it, which gave me a chance to work on the third book more, and that made it a lot better. I don't think people were really happy with the second book, partly because it's sort of half of a bridge. And if you walk halfway across a bridge, you don't really get anywhere. It really needed the third book to be complete. So I don't want to deliver another book two where I'm not completely satisfied with it. Book three, I got lots of time on. I thought it turned out pretty good. Book four, I want to turn out pretty good too.
Yeah, well, we're going to be looking forward to that. Take your time. Make sure that we enjoy it. This is the worst thing to say to a writer. And I know because I went to a writing program.
Yeah, and I would like to enjoy it. I want it to be a book I'm not miserable about.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're glad to have had this conversation and cleared up some very awesome stuff about the story you crafted.
Take care, everyone.
Bye. I get the fun combination of LaGuardia and Amtrak.
Yeah, I know. But as an editor of a podcast audio file every week, I know.
Okay.
Well, it's great. It's right, fine. It's not that destructive. Hi, back. I'm Dad.
Oh, God. We have a guest, Val.